Scarborough Fair. Parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme.
Writer Andrew Krivak told Large-Hearted Boy recently, "My parents fought with us about music all the time, classical versus the modern, but it was a good fight, and it taught me to see and appreciate the depth of tradition in all art. For their part, my parents had their moments of appreciation for what my brothers were listening to. They had a Tommy party once in which friends of theirs came to the house for drinks and to listen to and discuss that rock opera by The Who. They also liked Simon and Garfunkel. Who didn't? But Parsley, Sage, Rosemary, and Thyme held pride of place on the turntable when it was agreed that we would put on an album that suited everyone. My oldest brother told me recently that he had bought that album in 1967. It came out in late 66. In 1969, my father bought a Sylvania stereo for a family Christmas present, and the first album we played was Parsley, Sage, Rosemary, and Thyme. I know, because the last song, 7 o'clock news, Silent Night, scared the hell out of me when I first heard it, and I cried so that my mother had to hold me that Christmas Eve and tell me that it was just a song. But it's more than just a song, said Andrew Krivak. From the notes of the carol sung so beautifully comes the voice of the newscaster, the same male voice that was providing commentary on the war each night my dad watched the news, the grainy black and white footage, the body counts at the bottom of the screen like football scores. And I remember feeling the fear that my brothers would have to go there. And then, when I got old enough, I would go there too, because that's what a boy did when he became a young man. The song still makes me cry when I listen to it, no less relevant today than it was in the 60s, no less terrifying a time.
A special subcommittee of the House Committee on Un-American Activity has continued its probe into anti-Vietnam War protests. Demonstrators were forcibly evicted from the hearings when they began chanting anti-war slogans. Former Vice President Richard Nixon says that unless there is a substantial increase in the present war effort in Vietnam, the U.S. should look forward to 5 more years of war. In a speech before the Convention of the Veterans of Foreign Wars in New York, Nixon also said opposition to the war in this country is the greatest single weapon working against the U.S. That's the seven
words of writer Andrew Krivak from Book Notes, part of Large-Hearted Boy, January 2017. As it happens, the last chapter of Krivak's new novel opens on Christmas Eve as Beau and Ruth head into the woods to seek out the balsam fir selected as the family's Christmas tree that year. Beau's mom was back home brewing coffee and bracing for the huge snowstorm that was predicted. It turns out she'd heard the news the night before, the bombings that had been going on in North Vietnam, and she said it was a shame Nixon had to do that on Christmas. That from chapter 18 of The Signal Flame. So as in the song, and here in the story, and seemingly perpetually through the history of human civilization, the world is in continual conflict. And yet we perpetually long for, hope for, pray for peace, sleep in heavenly peace.
Call off the march, and the police in Cicero said they would ask the National Guard be called out if it is held. King now in Atlanta, Georgia, plans to return.
And if we listen to Simon and Garfunkel here in one of the stereo channels, there is the quiet simplicity as they sing Silent Night. In the other channel, the 7 o'clock newscast is filled not just with news of the war, but of suicide and murder and racism and all the heartache and thousand shocks that flesh is heir to. But as the volume of the newscast increases, Does it, will it, ultimately overwhelm the quiet carol, the plea for peace? Does such peace really exist? Can it prevail? How do we hold the tension?
In a speech before the Convention of the Veterans of Foreign Wars in New York, Nixon also said opposition to the war in this country is the greatest single weapon working against the U.S.
Andrew Krivak is a native of northeastern Pennsylvania, and Beau and Ruth and Hannah gather for the traditional Christmas Eve supper here in the Endless Mountains, a place Krivak calls Darden, as the culmination of a story that begins in the Easter season of 1972. Simon and Schuster describe the story in this way. In their small town in northeastern Pennsylvania, Hannah and her son Beau mourn the loss of the family patriarch, Joseph Wienisch. They were three generations under one roof, a war-haunted family in a war-torn century, but only one branch of a scraggy tree. Having survived the trenches of World War I as an Austro-Hungarian conscript, Josef journeyed to America and built a life for his children. His daughter Hannah married the European-born Bezsik Konár, who deserted the American army in World War II, and after his imprisonment was killed in a hunting accident on the family land. Finally, in 1971, Hannah's prodigal younger son, Sam, was reported missing in action in Vietnam. Beau, Hannah's remaining child, chooses a different path from his brother, quiet, full of conviction, and with a firstborn's sense of duty, he remains at home to grieve and to hope for reunion, to create new life, to embrace the land and work. Andrew Krivak's debut novel, The Sojourn, was a National Book Award finalist, and it received the Dayton Literary Peace Prize for fiction, as well as the inaugural Chautauqua Prize. He lives with his family in the greater Boston area. It seems as if Andrew Krivak has engaged throughout his life in fundamental ways with these matters that are foundational in our lives as humans, war and peace, love and home and family. His powerful memoir, A Long Retreat, takes its title, as we're told, from the 30 days of solitude, silence, and prayer in the discernment process in the Jesuit tradition, perhaps a space for posing such questions as, can we be at peace with ourselves and with each other in the midst of the perpetual turmoil of human affairs? Somehow, for Andrew Krivak, from the earliest times, the power of poetry, of words, of story, has had something to do with addressing that question. As if in creating narrative spaces, we as readers can enter those places where we can meet these full-bodied characters in their struggles and joys and enter more deeply into our own. Fascinating for us in our region is that Andrew Krivak's story unfolds in a place he and we know so well. And yet, because it is filtered through his vast creative imagination, we come to see this truly human turf freshly, profoundly, as if for the first time. We had a chance to speak by phone with Andrew Krivak about his novel, The Signal Flame, and his ties to northeastern Pennsylvania.
I was born at the General Hospital in Wilkes-Barre. I grew up in Plains, and my mother grew up in Dallas. And so they had a house built in Dallas back in the 60s. And so I grew up in Dallas, Pennsylvania, or more properly, as one of my friends from high school would say, in Fernbrook. So I was raised in Fernbrook and was there for 18 years of my life until I left to go off to college. So on Poplar Street, which is a dead-end street, and very mountainous, you know, anyone who's been in the back mountain. This was pre-flood, too, so before 1972, it was quite rural. Our street wasn't paved. I don't think we even got sewage until the mid-70s or so. But that just meant there was a lot of woods, a lot of trees, just the mountain. There was a hill called Snake Mountain behind our house, and my brother and I just roamed that place until we pretty much knew every rock and stick like the back of our hand. So that's where I grew up, out in Dallas. And I went to Dallas schools, Dallas High School. I graduated in 81. So that's my part of the world.
And did you know Fernbrook as the place where the big bands used to play?
No, that's a great question, because my father and mother talked about that all the time. My dad was great for big band music. He loved the Dorsey brothers, who were from Shenandoah. My dad was born in Shenandoah, and when his father died in the coal mines when my dad was three, classic case of the roof collapsing on my grandfather when they were robbing the pillars, you know, taking those stone pillars out. They brought my grandfather home in a box and gave my grandmother $500, and now she was a widow with four kids and a baby in the belly, 5 months along. So they then moved up to Plains, and she worked cleaning floors at Sacred Heart School, where my father and his brothers and sisters went for school as well. This is just before World War II. So then they all went off to the Army, and on the way home, they went to college on the GI Bill. So you had these men who literally leapfrogged from nothing to college-educated, white-collar men. So there was a lot of music in my family, and my father and mother, when they first dated, I guess it was called Fernbrook Park. You know, they enjoyed that place all the time. And they just talked about it, about what was there in the old days. And so, yeah, I knew all about it, but was too young to have experienced it.
Music was important, and Dad actually had some interest in classical music as well, and there was a musical milieu in which you were growing up.
That's right. My father said that he played the accordion when he was a boy, but, you know, for reasons he never went into, had to put it down. But I'll tell you, WVIA was on the radio in the car and on our stereo at home all the time. So we got quite an education in classical music and opera, too. My father loved the opera. And then, of course, my brothers, who were much older than I was. There was two boys, three girls, and then two younger boys, myself and my younger brother. They brought the 60s and the early 70s into our house. So, you know, the Doors, rock and roll was just on the stereo as well. And, there, you know, there was some tension, of course, between my father and my brothers, and then what my brothers were teaching me to listen to as well. But, you know, it was good, healthy tension. I think we had a great respect for each other's type of music. My father used to say that there's nothing in rock and roll that hasn't already been played in classical. And, you know, I found out down the road that that's quite true, in fact. But we all played. We all did something. You know, we took piano lessons or guitar lessons. My brother Tom was a rhythm guitar player in a local band in the 70s called Phoenix, which was very popular in the local bars. And I just loved playing the piano as well. I remember I played football in junior high school at Dallas Junior High, and I literally got my thumb crushed with these old-style cleats that we had, and I went to piano lessons with Mrs. Moran up the street from me, four houses up. And she looked at my thumb and she said, "You're going to have to make a decision. It's either football or it's piano." And so I saw the season out, you know, until November that year. And then I never played football in high school again. I went back to the piano. And that was my choice.
And you also told us that your household was filled with books.
Yeah, it really was. You know, my mother and father both went to college. They both had bachelor's degrees, and my father had a graduate degree as well. So if I imagine right now looking at the bookshelf in our living room, there's Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov, next to Kant's Critique of Pure Reason, next to St. Thomas Aquinas' Summa, next to Thomas Merton's Seven Story Mountain. So there were a lot of books. That was just, you know, the living room shelf. My mother was a scientist. She got a free ride to study biology at College of Misericordia. And imagine, she was the oldest in her family, a woman, and her father let her go to college in the late 40s, early 50s, I don't know exactly. So we were encouraged to read and do well and to do well in school, which wasn't always the easiest thing to pull off back there in Dallas in the days of yore. But, you know, I think part of my desire to sit down and write and to create something like a novel, like these novels I've been writing about fictional art in Pennsylvania, you know, it came out of that strength to say, I'm going to do this, and I don't care how much of a struggle it is socially. It's still something that I find better to do than anything else I could imagine. So I was glad for that kind of, somehow my parents taught me that persistence as well. I don't know where I got it otherwise. And now as you ask that question, I can't scan that house in my memory and not see a book on a shelf.
And it also sounds like there was a little foreshadowing there, because you wound up studying at an institution that might have been the reading list.
Yeah, St. John's College, Annapolis. And I'll tell you, it was my parents. I thought I had to go to a liberal arts college or university in New England, and I applied to a few of them. But it was my parents who said, you know, there's this school down in Annapolis, Maryland, that reads great books. You should really check it out. So again, imagine, 1980, Dallas, Pennsylvania. My parents are telling me to go study philosophy and read books for 4 years. So I checked it out, and it was just incredible. I can remember, I was just thinking about this the other day. The Iliad, of course, is the first book that you read in the seminars at St. John's College. But the next one was the Euthyphro, Plato's Euthyphro. And I can distinctly remember reading the Euthyphro and thinking, wow, I get to do this. And not only that, but tomorrow night I'm going to go sit around a table with 20 other people and talk about it. That was just, that was a mind blower to me at 18 or 19.
And there is a sequence in The Signal Flame where the character is there at a school where you read the great books. So it has served you in that way in the process of telling the story. It reveals something about the character.
Right. And that to me was the, in the long discernment about what do characters do, that to me was the point at which, you know, Bo Connor really wanted to look beyond the horizon of Dardan. But also he is in the, well, he's the one who stays home. And so he couldn't know that he wanted to stay unless he had gone out and sought those books, fallen in love, and then come back due to other, to more tragic reasons. But a college like St. John's College would have been the place where he could have gone for a semester and realized it wasn't for him and left. So, you know, that's, I think that's why it's just the college in the book, but others may see more. So, and that's fine. I wanted to say, too, was curious about Dallas in the 70s and 80s. You know, the class ahead of me, there was a gentleman who went to Caltech. Class ahead of him, there was someone who went to Stanford. And in my own class, a young woman went to Smith and another went to Brandeis. And certainly, I think there were a few who went to Penn State, Maine, and State College. So there was, as I look back, a great deal of, what should I say, academic aspiration, all for good reasons. So, you know, I think that was a function of Dallas itself, kind of, you know, coming to a place where there was, how should I say this, there was a lot more reading and intellectual curiosity going on, now I realize, than in my place of, as a 17-year-old I was able to see.
It's curious, too, to us to say the place where the story unfolds, Dardan, there's certainly an ancient reverberation when we think about Homer and the Dardanoi and Dardanelles.
Right.
Was that just a salute to that? How did you choose that name?
It's just a salute. You know, the classical world was my first literary world, and so I feel like I'll always salute that. You know, the creek that goes through town, which is, my friends and I used to hang out on Toby Creek that ran through Fernbrook. And so the creek that runs through town, while it bears no resemblance to any of those actual creeks, I called the Salamander for, you know, the Scamander, which ran through Troy. So that those kind of things. It's just, you know, the symbols are there insofar as they help me anchor my own literary eye and sort of cosmos or order to a place that I know, having studied classical literature myself. Dardan really exists nowhere, actually, you know, geographically. There's mention of the Endless Mountains where lumber comes from, and the mill is called the Endless Roughing Mill. But I describe it in Chapter 2 as this place that just, you know, it's not any town I'm trying to recreate where I lived in, for instance, Dallas or anything. It's just, I imagine this almost a fictional place, if it were to be on a map somewhere in northeastern Pennsylvania up in the mountains. That's what it would be. It would be this place of Dardan where a classical river stream runs through, and people struggle like they always have done since the earliest times.
And that does take us to Homer and the Greeks. And you had said it was Homer where you first came to understand what poetry could do. And I wanted to ask you to elaborate a little bit more about what you meant by that.
Yeah, so at St. John's College, you study Greek for your first 2 years, and they're very small tutorials, so you learn a lot of Greek very quickly. By our sophomore year, we were reading the Gospels in Greek, and then the language tutorial becomes a project of picking a piece of ancient Greek literature that the tutor picks. So we read Book 11 of the Odyssey through, line by line, translating every time we met for class. But part of our assignment as well was to pick another passage to memorize it, and to do a sort of a critical paper on your translation of this. And I picked the passage of Scylla and Charybdis. And I just, wow, you know, I still think back to that. The word for where Charybdis vomits up the sea is this, I'll get it wrong, I'm sure, for any of the classicists out there, but it's anamor muresca, you know? Just imagine that sort of, that onomatopoetic vomiting of the ocean that's so massive, it's terrifying to any sailor who goes past it. And translating that, memorizing it, to me was just fascinating. I'd never had an experience like that in any classroom. And it made me realize, in fact, that that poetry is, or any literature, that there's a beauty to it as well as a you know, a critical purpose to telling a story. And that's what fascinated me the most. How can language be so, how can you make it as beautiful as it is full of content to propel a story? And so poetry really, to me, was the first thing I loved. And I should go back too to say a bit that I had friends that in high school who also, you know, loved poetry. I remember going to see Gregory Orr at what was then Wilkes College when I was maybe 16. Someone had just gotten the license, and we drove down to the Dorothy Dixon Dart Center and saw Gregory Orr, and it was, you know, it was just amazing to see a real poet and listen to a real poet read poetry. And my older brothers, too, would pass along books to me, so of course I read On the Road in high school, and I was reading Lawrence Ferlinghetti poetry. And that sound of poetry, when I started studying Greek, I realized, wow, the sound of those beat poets is no different, and it doesn't come from any place different from the very sound of Homer himself. That was a clincher for me.
It's clear to me that you're an author with a sense of the oral tradition as well as the literary written tradition, and that you work in that way. Do you cultivate the line and things like that? Are there moments where you go back and say, if I only found the right, I'll get it?
Not just times, Erica, every time. I am the consummate go back over and listen to. I read out loud. I don't think a book's finished, even if it's a 3-page essay, a 30-page short story, or a 300-word novel. I've got to read it out loud and listen to every single word and every sentence before it's right for me. And you know, there's the piano lessons right there. I didn't get much farther than 5 years, and I could play some Scott Joplin ragtime, and I still mess around playing jazz chords and things like that. But for me, the music is in that when I'm alone in a room with words and just writing a sentence. And I think, you know, writers, if I could speak to any of the young writers out there, it's hard to let yourself dwell on a sentence when you think, oh my God, I've got a whole book I need to write. But that's part of it. You know, you have to take that long view and let yourself write a good sentence from the beginning to the end. Because when it's done, you send it off to the editor and the publisher, and your book is only as good as the last sentence you've written. So don't just enjoy the music, but play it as well as you possibly can.
We also know that not only did you go to St. John's, but then you spent some time in and among and deciding about whether or not you might want to follow the path of St. Ignatius, the Jesuit path. And you and I talked about the spiritual exercises and what that is and how that might connect to you as a writer, or anyone as a writer, in terms of imagination and getting it down on the page.
Yeah, that's true. I should preface this by saying that for me, you know, my parents were devoted Catholics from a Eastern European Slovak cultural and religious community and tradition, and so we went to Mass. It was what we did. We went to St. Teresa's in Shavertown, and for me, the church was a deep, fulfilling, and beautiful tradition. So that really stuck with me. And you know, there was also this sense of which the theological, the philosophical, and the scriptural all came together. You know, not exactly as literature, but I heard in the liturgical cycle of the readings from Mass, those stories. And to me, they were as much stories as they were a kind of moral and moral theology. So it doesn't almost, it's no surprise that I would have thought, after a philosophical education and being raised in that part of the world, that I would think about, you know, the priesthood. Initially, I was, probably because of Thomas Merton, I really wanted to be a Trappist. But I visited some monasteries, and there was something missing there. I still wanted to be out in the world. And I was a grad student in the writing program at Columbia University, I met some Jesuits, and they lived up in the South Bronx, and they were just right in the thick of it in Hunts Point. And I spent the summer with these guys, just teaching math to kids at high, getting them ready for high school. Because they had nothing. This was when crack was king in the city too, in the late '80s. And to to take these kids to a Yankees game at night and then walk home, and all of us are terrified of the drug dealers on the corner, the kids as well as me. But, you know, they trusted that we were walking for some other reason, and so nothing bad ever happened. But it was after that summer where I went to the vocation director of the Jesuits and said, I want to do this. I think this is right for me. 8 years later, I realized that it was not right for me. And part of it was just the sense of creativity that I didn't, while I began with this ideal of really wanting to do something different in the world, I think I came to realize that a vocation as a writer or doing something more creative in the world was where I was being called, you know. And so the Jesuits are great about spiritual direction. If my discernment was leading me out, then I should go and with their blessings. So the book I wrote about that, A Long Retreat, was really a kind of a meditation on moving into, moving through, and moving out of this period of religious life. And when I think about writing, St. Ignatius Loyola had this meditation called a composition of place in the spiritual exercises. You imagine, say, for instance, a scripture passage, being in the storm on the Sea of Galilee. And you put yourself in there and try to feel that fear and that wonder. So when I was writing The Signal Flame, when I was 9 in 1972, the way I got back to that was first, you know, talking to my brothers on the phone about a lot of practical things. Then, like I mentioned to you, listening to music, listening to The Doors and to Grand Funk and to anything prior to 1972, Cat Stevens, and remembering what that was like, remembering the sound of the time. And, you know, that I still carry a lot of that Jesuit training, if you will, with me. And, you know, I cannot not at this point.
And I wonder how you think about the sense of place and that grounding for us as humans in a place. Today, so often we're living in virtual space.
Right.
How do you think about placing us, grounding us, rooting us, not just in home, because home is something obviously you're exploring, but the natural world and our being part of a place?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I actually think about this a lot. My oldest brother, who's lived on Cape Cod for, gosh, as long as I can remember, he always says, you know, you can take the boy out of Pennsylvania, but you can't take the Pennsylvania out of the boy. And so I just, for me, growing up on that hill in Dallas, we were just outside all the time. And after I left and lived in various places of the world, by and large urban, New York, close to Washington, London, and then as a Jesuit, I lived in Moscow for a summer and some Eastern European cities. Something about the cities really pulled me to people and to that kind of rush of humanity. But that desire to always find something in nature never left me. And so my Pennsylvania novel is, in a way, a chance for me to go back there into the quiet, because I see it. You know, I see it with my kids. They just want to be on video games all the time. And so we have a little place in New Hampshire I take them up to, and on a lake in there, and we, you know, I get them out, no screens, no games, just get in the woods, get in the water, and they kind of, sometimes they complain, but other times they lean right in, and they love it. And it reminds me that, you know, we lived outside. My mother's favorite expression when we do the classic, "Mom, I'm bored," she'd say, "Go outside." And I realized, wow, this is where she grew up. She grew up in the house right next to the house that we grew up in. So she never, you know, except to work in a Corsair fighter factory in Connecticut during World War II, she never left that hill. And in a way that we, what does Joni Mitchell say, you know, you don't know what you've got till it's gone. I think about that natural education I received back there in Pennsylvania. You know, it wasn't the Grand Tetons, it wasn't the White Mountains. It was just northeastern Pennsylvania, and it was what I was given. And so I've made a great deal out of it because I really did love it so much, being outside, you know, in any season. And so that sense of place, I can't take that Pennsylvania out of this boy. And in some ways I feel grateful as a writer to have that to draw on and to put my characters back in there and see how they'll do, what they'll do.
And you use the word struggle, and they certainly do have to face many struggles and trials in an area which was part of an extractive industry. And you mentioned the fate of your poor grandfather. And in the course of the telling of this story, we learn about the successive wars of humankind, whether it be the European Wars, 1, 2, Vietnam.
Yeah, I mean, I heard I heard so many stories about my grandfather's, my mother's father fought in the Austrian army as a Slovak conscript against the Italians on the Piave River and was captured and sent to a prisoner of war camp in Sardinia, and then walked home to the new country of Czechoslovakia and then came to America. So he died of black lung in the 50s, so there's another mining casualty. And it was apparently, you know, just a really great guy, real master carpenter. But the idea of the war, so that my father fought in World War II, and when I was, you know, in the early 70s, my brothers were thinking, all right, it's Vietnam for us. We're on the way, and we're not really sure if we want to go. But I was pretty conscious from early on about this sort of succession of you grow up, you sort of come of age and fight a war, and then, you know, if you come back, you get on with your life. And that was just the way I seemed to frame it as a boy. No one told me that's what you did, but it seemed like that's the way things shook out from what I could see of the men in my family. And so, of course, you know what? My brothers didn't go to Vietnam. By the time my oldest brother was ready to go, I think the draft stopped or the war was over, but regardless. And I remember another interviewer asking me once, well, so why didn't you go into the military after that? And, I just don't have the warrior spirit. But the fact of that stretch in America really stuck with me, so that, you know, come St. John's College, to read the Iliad then and to think about that Greek word for the struggle, the agon, made a lot of sense to me. And that's in tragic literature as well as all literature. I had a great English teacher at Dallas High School, Donna Trebilcox, who once said that you can find the conflict of every story on the first page. And she challenged us, and sometimes she was finding it in the first sentence, and I was like, wow, this is so cool. And, you know, I think that's really true, that a good story has to, that struggle. You know, often I'll ask students, when I did teach, I don't teach anymore, but I'll say, you know, what's the struggle? What's the wound? What is the, what's the conflict? And there's where your story is going to emerge and find its life, find its arc, if you will. And so that's why that history of warfares stretches through the signal flame, because it's what I remember. You know, and so in one scene where Bo is talking to Ruth and she says, well, Cronkite said Nixon wants all the troops home by September. I watched the news with my dad, and I remember as early as, you know, 1970 when I was about, I think I was six or seven. You know, you might as well, Erica, the sort of the grainy footage, the elephant grass, the choppers, you know, and the body counts on the screen, U.S., V.C. So that's very powerful in my memory. And that's another composition of place for this novel that I attempted to recreate, to get that feel. And again, to go back to St. Ignatius Loyola, if I can, for just a second, his favorite Spanish verb was sentir, to feel, you know, feel that place. And so that's what I was trying to really get at.
It's both and in the story. You want us to experience the natural cycles, but also that liturgical cycle.
That's right. In fact, I wrote the book precisely, even before I had the arc of a narrative, I wanted to write a book that followed that liturgical cycle. So if you go back to The Sojourn, for instance, Joseph Vinich is alive and he tells the story of his coming of age on March 31st, 1972, which was Good Friday. So there's that sort of what the Greeks would call the katabasis, the descent to the underworld, where he talks about the war. And so in The Signal Flame, initially Joseph was alive and he died in the course of the book, but that didn't work. And so that first page, Joseph is dead. And now that book is about Bo, or the arc of the narrative is about Bo. But it's April now, it's Easter, it's roughly April 10th in 1972. And the book was called, I wrote most of the book with the working title of As We Wait, from the section of the liturgy where just before it's over, where the priest says, as we wait in joyful hope for the coming. And that's always just, I thought, could I write a book about waiting? Is there anything powerful or sort of, you know, can you drive a narrative to be about waiting? And I realized again that liturgical arc, so from Easter season to Christmas Eve, and it has to be Christmas Eve, the book finishes on that sort of sense of you know, waiting for a baby to arrive, that time of the feast, the Slovak Velia feast on Christmas Eve is the vigil, you know, it's that moment where just before Christ is among us. So there's the book is not overly religious at all, except for the priestly character that I really like, Father Rob Navaja. He emerged over time, but there is a great deal of in that natural as well as spiritual cycle, in those periods of feast and fast and just ordinary time. Like the summer is is ordinary time, and that doesn't necessarily mean mundane. Things don't happen. It's ordinal, you know, from the Latin, the counting down and the waiting for small things and for big things. And so that's what I try to affect with that, waiting for the small as well as for the big, things that are just bigger than we could possibly imagine.
You told us so well about what you were discovering about poetry through Homer and the beauty and the language and the music and so forth. How do you come down in talking about the importance of literature and the arts for us, where we are today?
Oh, wow, such a big question. And in some ways, it seems to me so obvious because it does, you know, literature understood is, I think there's something about recognizing the struggle and that there can be a beauty and it doesn't have to be hard and debilitating. There's an arc of our lives, and it's not exactly just an acceptance, but it's finding those things that are greater than ourselves, finding something beautiful in the world, and seeing that there are others out there as well who are doing the same. To me, that's the value of literature. And in this particular period, I've been going back and reading a lot of poetry, and oddly enough, I've been going back to my early Plato. I just reread the Euthyphro, which we began this conversation with just the other night. A friend of mine and I are talking about it. But that's the great value of literature, is that it's not just a distraction. It's not something that you do to feel good, but it's a way in which we can look at a mirror of others' lives to reflect on our own. And not necessarily for the hard things, although I do believe there's a value in seeing how hard others' lives are, but just understanding the arc, whether it's a difficult one or whether there's moments of peace, this is what we're on. And understanding that, being aware of that, to me is the value of it. And asking questions and recognizing that the world is a place to find beauty and creativity. Because, you know, what else is there, really? Sort of like in the novel, you'll see the Slovak word krasna or krasny as a sort of leitmotif when Joseph holds up the trout. Tak krasny, hey, beautiful, isn't it? You know, that's the Slovak translation. And the dog krasna, who's beautiful. To me, that's what we have to search for and look for in order to make this somehow worthwhile.
In Los Angeles today, comedian Lenny Bruce died of what was believed to be an overdose of narcotics. Bruce was 42 years old. Dr. Martin Luther King says he does not intend to cancel plans for an open housing March Sunday into the Chicago suburb of Cicero. Cook County Sheriff Richard Ogilvie asked King to call off the march, and the police in Cicero said they would ask the National
Award-winning writer Andrew Krivak, a native of northeastern Pennsylvania who grew up in the Back Mountain just outside of Wilkes-Barre, speaking with us about his new novel, The Signal Flame, just issued by Scribner for Simon & Schuster, a story that unfolds here in our region. For more information on the web, andrewkrivak.com, and Krivak is spelled K-R-I-V-A-K, andrewkrivak.com, or SimonAndSchuster.com.
Richard Nixon says that unless there is a substantial increase in the present war effort in Vietnam, the U.S. should look forward to 5 more years of war. In a speech before the convention of
the Signal Flame, the second novel from National Book Award finalist Andrew Krivak, issued by Scribner. And for more information on the web, andrewkrivak.com, andrewkrivak.com.